This episode of the Side Hustle Project is brought to you by FreshBooks, cloud accounting and invoicing software for freelancers, solopreneurs, and side hustlers. I've personally used FreshBooks as my go-to invoicing software since day one with my freelance business, even back when I was freelancing on the side of my day job. And as my business has grown over the years, so has FreshBooks. You can now create and send professional-looking invoices in 30 seconds, accept online payments from your clients, and much, much more. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to listeners of The Side Hustle Project. To claim your free trial, just go to freshbooks.com/Ryan and enter The Side Hustle Project in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Welcome to The Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson. In this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to James Altucher, the founder of more than 20 companies, including a web design firm that began as a side hustle. He spent 18 months running his web design company on the side, including hiring a dozen employees while he still kept his day job. This was in the mid-90s, before the World Wide Web had proliferated into every home in America, so James had a very unique, valuable skill set. And he was able to use that to create the early websites for HBO, American Express, and Time Warner. And he went on to sell his web design company for $15 million just 2 years after starting it. But then he lost everything, like $0 in his account, everything. James found himself in debt to banks, the IRS, friends, and family. You just did this really exciting thing. You sold your first company for $15 million. What came next?
Blowing $15 million. Like I bought a house, I bought artwork. I started investing in all these like crappy companies that I did not know the first thing about, you know, proper angel investing, and I would invest way too much of my money and without contracts and without any understanding of, you know, how angel investing works. And I'd start new companies that were horrible, and I just blew it all. I just pissed it all away. Everything. I ended up with zero.
And right here is where many people give up, pack it in, take a corporate job, and resign from the life of entrepreneurship for good. But that wasn't going to work for James. He kept reinventing himself over and over again. James would go on to build and sell another company, get much better at angel investing, make his way into running a hedge fund. He'd become a best-selling author of more than 11 books, start a world-renowned podcast. And that only scratches the surface of everything James has done. In today's episode, we're talking about how James got his first clients for his side hustle developing websites, and how he grew that into a $15 million acquisition. We're diving into the one thing James can look back at and point to as the driver of nearly all of his successes: building a network of smart, talented, connected people and forging genuine relationships with them. We're exploring how to validate your idea without spending a dollar, and what James' creative process looks like when he finds himself interested in something new. We're covering how to start over after crippling failure, and the ways in which James deals with the anxieties, ups and downs of being an entrepreneur. All of this and much more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with James Altucher. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ryan, who is sometimes confused with Ryan Gosling, thank you so much.
All right, warm-up question for you. What book are you reading right now, or what's been your favorite recently?
Well, I'm really enjoying, the book came out yesterday, my good friend Ryan Holiday's book, Perennial Seller, which on the surface is about how some books end up selling forever. Like take Catcher in the Rye. It was published in 1951 and still sells a million copies a year. But it's more than about books. It's about how to have an idea that connects with so many people through generations that it just, the idea continues to last and survive. And in why do some ideas last and others don't? Like he makes an interesting observation. I hope you don't mind me talking about this book, actually. I'm reading it right now, so I'm fascinated by it. But he makes this interesting observation that the weekend Star Wars came out, it wasn't even the top-selling movie at the box office that weekend, which I didn't know. Smokey and the Bandit was the top-selling movie at the box office that weekend in 1977.
Wow.
And yet, of course, nobody, like not a single person this year watched Smokey and the Bandit, and yet Star Wars is watched constantly by people of all generations every year.
So what, if you had to distill down his core idea or the conclusion, perhaps, what do you feel like that is that makes a perennial bestseller?
I think what makes a perennial bestseller is a combination of old and new. So you take something like Star Wars, you know, it's the classic arc of the hero, which is a storytelling trope or genre lasted for thousands of years. I mean, Jesus is the arc of the hero, and that obviously is a story that's lasted thousands of years. But it's the combination of that with the new. So how can we age that concept and bring the new to it? So you combine that idea with the idea of a classic Western with science fiction special effects better than had just ever been done before, and bam, you've got the top-selling movie franchise of all time.
So, James, you've held a lot of different titles over the years. Can you start us off by describing what you do today?
It's funny because a friend of mine is supposed to visit me later to do a day in the life. He's a writer. And I'll give like a just kind of a 24-hour period. Like the basic day for me is my morning hours are what I call maker hours. Like that's when I'm creative. And my afternoon hours are my manager or administrative hours. That's where, you know, I'm involved in a lot of different businesses, and but it's not rocket science to do administrative or even managerial stuff. So that's when I spend my time on the phone, kind of just making sure everything's going okay, talking to the different businesses I'm involved in and so on. The hard part is when you want is the creative stuff, what you want to do in the morning, or at least for me, when my mind is at its most active. And then I do kind of the administrative stuff later, and then I have fun and then go to sleep early. But a day in the life for me today is a little weird because I'm gonna I have a dinner with a hedge fund manager that they're a multi-billion-dollar hedge fund, but they want to be an activist on a public company that they own a big stake in. And so I had an idea for them, which I sent to the guy, and he said, "Oh, we definitely have to meet." So we're meeting later today, and then after that, performing some stand-up comedy because I'm trying to get better at that skill. Not that I want to be a great stand-up comedian, but I want that skill. It's a different skill set than any other skill set I've encountered. And then in the morning tomorrow, I'll write and so on. But then I have a podcast with a former CIA agent who also has sold several businesses since the CIA. He was an expert in cybersecurity. So we're going to talk about that. Like that's how he got into the CIA. And then in the evening tomorrow, I have a live podcast in front of an audience with Jason Calcanis, who has a new book out called Angel, which describes how he became, I've known him for 22 years, but he describes how he became one of the best angel investors of all time, essentially. And then, so that's kind of like a typical set of days for me.
So what's getting your number one creative focus right now? You mentioned tomorrow morning you're going to be doing some writing. Is that sort of your number one?
Well, writing for 15 years has been my number one. Like I write every single day, you know, or at least try to without fail. And that's been since 2002. But I actually started writing around 1991. And then but around 2002, I started professionally doing it. And then, you know, again, that's how long it takes, like, to start something before you're then, you know, professional. And then I would say I'm barely good at it starting around now. So every skill is much harder than people think. Not that you can't do something successfully and financially well in the beginning, but to really kind of master the subtleties of something takes a long time and there's no shortcuts. And that includes entrepreneurship, writing, performing, public speaking, selling, you know, whatever it is you want to get good at. But I would say lately my podcast is my number one creative focus because, you know, it used to be the case I'd walk outside and people would stop me in the street. Not that I'm famous or anything. This is like once in a billion. Someone would stop me in the street and say, "Oh my gosh, I love your writing. I love your book, Choose Yourself." Now nobody stops me for my writing, but everybody stops me for, oh, I love your podcast. I listen to every one of your podcasts. So I decided I'm going to just quadruple down on my podcast. Like, I'm going to go from one episode a week to five episodes a week and see where it goes. And I'm hiring like a really great producer, and we'll see how it goes.
Oh, that's awesome. We'll all have to tune in. So what's the name of the podcast so everyone can listening here today can go find it?
The James Altucher Show.
Awesome. And you've had on guests like, I know, Mark Cuban, Seth Godin, Gary Vaynerchuk, Tim Ferriss, a lot of names that people recognize. Who would you say has been your favorite or most surprising interview guest?
You know, that's hard to say. I've had like almost 300 guests at this point, because I have a lot in the can as well that I haven't yet released. I have on a guest when I really admire them as a peak performer, like they've achieved the best in the world at something. So Mark Cuban, you know, you can argue this is a guy who, you know, not only is a billionaire, which you can argue that's a sign of peak performance. I think that's a sign of peak performance at business. And he also owns the Dallas Mavericks, which has become like the best basketball team in the league, or one of them. And he's always loved basketball. So he's able to take this thing that he's loved since he was a kid, and he wasn't going to become a professional basketball player, but he sort of pivoted that interest to owning a basketball team, and he became a peak performer at that. But that's an example of like business. You mentioned a bunch of guys who are business related, but most of my guests are not business related at all. I've had on writers, astronauts, artists, musicians, comedians, you know, skateboarders, people from all, like Tony Hawk was on my podcast. Marcus Lemonis, who does the podcast, who does the TV show The Prophet's been on. Coolio, the rapper's been on. Amanda Palmer, the musician's been on. You know, Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian's been on. I've had so many great guests from every walk of life. And I say they're great not because they were such great guests, although most of them were, but because they were like heroes to me. They were real peak performers in an area that I admired. And so I can't really say who's the best because they're all so different. That's a cop-out answer. I'm sorry, but that's really the truth. There's a lot of guests that I have not on that I'd really like to get on who are peak performers in their life.
Who's your number one target right now that you've been trying to get?
Probably, I mean, if you really look at the arc of this guy's career, it's such an example of how to achieve peak performance. I really admire this guy, regardless of the field he's in, just the way he's tackled becoming a peak performer. But that's probably Louis C.K. in comedy.
So, James, can you take us back to your very first job after college, working for HBO? What did you do for them?
So, by the way, that wasn't my very first job after college, but close enough. I consider that my first real job after college. Like, I was a programmer for a bunch of different companies, and I hated it, and I was very bad at it. Like, I was disrespectful. I was a kid. I wasn't really responsible in the ways I should have been. So that's why I consider HBO my first real job, because that's the first job I'm like, oh my gosh, I love this job and I want to do good at it. And of course, I didn't do what I was hired to do. I didn't do anything remotely similar to what I was hired to do. I was hired to be just a I was hired to be a computer programmer to work on interactive TV through the cable system. So, and I was like, I said to my boss at the time, this is 1994, I said, you know, there's this new thing called the World Wide Web on the internet, and there's this web browser called Mozilla, which we can hook up to everybody, and they can watch interactive TV through that. And you could download, the networking infrastructure is all set up for you. You could download videos through this thing called the internet. And my boss was like, James, the internet's for academics. Why don't you let the cable guys do what they do best and let them make these kinds of decisions? So after that, I really kind of lost interest in what I was doing. So I switched focus completely. I mean, I wasn't allowed to switch focus, but I continued to do the minimal necessary at my job. And then at the same time, I secretly installed an intranet on HBO. So I completely hooked up everybody to an internal intranet, hooked up to all of HBO's databases. And I could describe that more, but it's not that important. But they were blown away by it. And then they let me do whatever I wanted with their internet website. And then I took ideas from the internet website and I pitched a TV show to them, which they gave me money to shoot as a pilot. And I really loved entertainment at the time. And I really loved the television industry. I mean, I still love the television industry. This is over 20 years later. And then other companies came up to me, other entertainment companies came up to me and said, hey, what you did for HBO, can you do it for us? And I said, sure. So while I was at HBO doing my full-time job, I was on the side doing websites for almost every other entertainment company in the world. And I built up a business on the side. It took me 18 months, still staying at my full-time job, before I left my full-time job to run my business full-time. My business at that time probably had a dozen clients, you know, well over a dozen employees. We had our own office. I was the CEO, and I would just work all day at my full-time job and then all night at my side business.
Mm-hmm. And this was your first side hustle, right?
No, I mean, I always, since I was a kid, I've been side hustling.
Ah, what would you say was your very first project you tried out on the side?
Well, when I was 12, I found this newspaper box. You know, you could put a quarter and you get out the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd put a quarter in and I would take out 50 newspapers and sell them for 20 cents each. And so that was probably my first real side hustle, and I got caught immediately and got in big trouble. And then, I don't know, I was always doing things. I took a job after school doing cold calling for newspaper subscriptions. I would walk around New York City trying to pick up cans of Coke that were thrown out, and you could turn them in for 5 cents. I was a newspaper boy. In college, I probably worked 60 hours a week in college and then took classes for another like 30 or 40 hours a week. And I'm not even exaggerating. I worked so hard in college because I paid for everything in my college, tuition, housing, everything. I started a business in college. It was like kind of almost think of like Grubhub or Seamless.com. Mm-hmm. I started that for my college town where I went to college, and kept that running for almost a year. And then I set up a debit card so people could charge delivery. And there was no kids had credit cards or debit cards back then. So I wrote to every parent and they sent in money for their kids so they could track what their kids were buying. And then I set up deals with all the restaurants in town. I'll deliver the food even if you just accept my debit card. And then I programmed a point of sale machine. Nobody had ever even seen a point of sale machine before. I programmed a point-of-sale machine so people could run the card through when they use my card. I negotiated discounts for anybody who used my card. And so that was sort of my first actual business on the side. And then I just kept doing stuff like that. You never, mm-hmm. If you ever are stuck doing one thing, it's not that you're in trouble, but just start finding another thing to do. Like you always want to do multiple things. Like even with that business, not only did we have the card, I sold advertising on the back of the card. I still don't know a credit card company that sells advertising on the back of the card. I sold two ads to fill up all our quote unquote ad inventory on the back of cards. And then I set up a delivery business. You know, it was great. Like, so MasterCard called us and they wanted to come down and buy us, but my partners were against the idea. And then a year later, we were out of business.
So going back to the web design business, the one that you started on the side at HBO, do you remember who your very first client was with that?
Yeah, well, so for one thing, HBO was my first client.
Sure.
So I became the decision maker on who would do HBO's website. So, and meanwhile, I had started a company on the side. So I hired my own company to do HBO's website. Just another thing. It's equivalent to stealing the newspaper out of the newspaper, but but we did a good job and it was worth it, you know, so nobody complained. I told them later what had happened. I should have told them in the beginning, but I told them later and nobody complained. Nobody was upset. And, but outside of HBO, I also was doing, I did AmericanExpress.com, like the original AmericanExpress.com. I did a bunch of sites for like people, a lot of, you know, HBO is owned by Time Warner. So I did a lot of sites for Time Warner, like People Magazine, did stuff for Sports Illustrated, did stuff for Warner Brothers, New Line Cinema, Warner Music, Then I moved in a little bit into the Sony/BMG family. I did Loud Records, then I did Bad Boy Records, then Interscope, which is owned by Universal, then Miramax, which was, you know, Disney. And I was just plowing through all of them.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any trends about how you were landing those gigs? I mean, since you were in the Time Warner umbrella, I guess that helps. But still, like, you got to reach out to people, right? Or were they coming to you?
You got to reach out to people. But the most important thing is, like, cold calling is really hard. Like, one time I cold called a bank, and they just sort of – and here I was. I did HBO, American Express, you know, and I listed my professional, not entertainment, my more professional websites like ConEdison.com, which is a utility company. And they just sort of laughed at me. Like, cold calling is hard. So it's really, you just got to spend a lot of time building your network. And that works, you know, right away within 1 month. But also, here it is now 22 years later, and still the network that I started building then helps me find opportunities right now. Like, network is the most important asset you have as a human being. And so that's what you've got to make use of. You've got to feed into your network, meaning you've got to take care of it. You've got to treat it well. You've got to make it always feel good. And then, you know, when you want good behavior from your network, it's there.
This is something that consistently comes up with just about every entrepreneur I've interviewed. This conclusion, often in hindsight, that your network is your net worth. That the quality of the relationships you build with ambitious, talented, hungry people will go on to define your career. James is straightforward about much of his success coming from his network, whether that's in the form of leveraging opportunities to work together on a project, asking for introductions to a mutual connection that can help accelerate his work, finding an investor, or something else entirely. The evidence is overwhelming that the quality, not just the quantity, of your network is one of the highest return investments you can possibly make in yourself. Up next, after this short break from our sponsor, James and I are talking about how he found a buyer for his web design company, what he did with his $15 million after selling, and how he recovered from being completely broke. Stay tuned.
This episode of The Side Hustle Project is brought to you by FreshBooks, cloud accounting and invoicing software for freelancers, solopreneurs, and side hustlers. As you know, I personally use FreshBooks to do the invoicing for my freelance business. And the reason why I've stuck with FreshBooks for so long is because I hate dealing with the accounting side of running my business. I'm just not a numbers person, and I'd rather spend my time doing what I do best, which is getting results for my clients. And that's where FreshBooks really comes into play for me. Their completely redesigned suite of tools range from invoice customization to analytics and insights that show when your clients are actually viewing your invoices. The ability to easily take upfront deposits for new projects, accept online payments, and much, much more. Getting started is extremely simple, even if you're not a numbers person. Actually, especially if you're not a numbers person. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to listeners of The Side Hustle Project. To claim your free trial, just go to freshbooks.com/Ryan and enter The Side Hustle Project in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
So you ran the web design firm for about 2 years before selling it. How did you find a buyer for the company?
Well, again, a lot of it is it's all network, really. So, yeah. So I remember one time I always wanted to get sold because I had zero money in the bank. And I was like, oh, if anybody even offered me like a tiny amount of money, I'll sell it. Hmm. So first HBO looked at buying it. They didn't buy it. Then I met with this woman, I remember her name, Felice Kincannon, who was doing all the acquisitions at Omnicom, which is the largest ad agency in the world. And she invested in our competitors like Razor, you know, our earlier competitors. They were a little older than us, like Razorfish and Organic Online and a few others. And I would just call her and say, hey, I'd love to meet and show you my company. And I met and I showed her my company. And she said, you know, you're not quite big enough for us yet. But I had breakfast with her once a month for 2 years before she started making offers for the company. And that's what you just got to do. You just got to put in the time and identify the right people who are good people, who are connected people, who are doing the, who are the decision makers, you know, who could say yes to you, and just start meeting them all the time. And I, and then just take advantage of every opportunity. So one time I was at Loud Records. So Loud Records is the, kind of music label, which, they discovered the Wu-Tang Clan and Mobb Deep and they were doing stuff with Busta Rhymes. They were doing a lot of, like well-known kind of rap groups. And so I was doing their website, and a stockbroker from Prudential, who was doing his own networking, was in the office, and he was pitching the owner. The owner was this guy named Steve Ripkin. And Steve said to me, come into this meeting. I don't understand a word this guy is saying. And this guy was saying, Steve, you own Loud Records, you own five-star basketball camps, you own your street teams, which sell, you know, you sell Pepsi Cola into Harlem, and, you know, you're expert at marketing into, you know, those demographics. Why don't you combine them all together and go public, and we'll take it public. He said, I'll take it public. And Steve was like, you know, maybe. And, but then that guy got my card or my phone number or whatever, and he started calling me, and I returned his call, and I went into a meeting, and he was just a tiny broker at Prudential, but he acted like he was a huge big shot. So he, like, I came in for a meeting. He rented out this huge conference room. He had other tiny brokers in the meeting, like taking notes, like all fake because he was nothing. And meanwhile, then he started calling around every other web agency and created an auction for my company, totally on the side of his main business, which was being a stockbroker.
Wow.
So then he eventually I got like four or five offers for my company, and he was negotiating all the time, back and forth, back and forth. And I was saying no to a lot of these guys because they were offering me all these things called earnouts where you're making the money mm-hmm. over time. And so finally he negotiated a deal that I accepted. And then where did I place all my money for him to be the stockbroker on? Of course, with him. So it was good for him in many ways. Plus, he made a 3% fee on the deal. And from that 3% fee, he started day trading and made millions of dollars for himself. So, like, networking is so important. And by the way, it's all about psychology. We would talk on the phone all the time. Mm-hmm. First getting to know each other and getting to realize how we got along, and then figuring out how to communicate to other people and answer the questions that would inevitably be asked. Like someone would ask, well, why are you trying to sell now? Why don't you just grow it yourself? Because the implication is maybe they thought I wasn't confident enough in the business. And we would work out answers. Like, I legitimately just wanted to be part of a bigger team, but I also wanted to make that first amount of cash that I ever made. Mm-hmm. So, but you can't really just say that. I mean, I probably could have, but at the time I felt I couldn't. And so we would just work through all the scripts and scenarios, and it's all about psychology and networking and not lying, because people know when you're lying. You want to be honest,
right?
But there's lots of ways to be honest, and you want to be honest in such a way that intersects with what other people want out of their lives and their companies and their agendas. You mm-hmm. want to make their lives better.
So when you sold the web design company, you did not take an earnout deal. So you took straight cash. Do you remember how much you took for the sale of the company?
Yeah, I mean, I took some cash in stock, but then I sold all the stock, and it was mm-hmm. about $15 million.
And what came next for you then?
Blowing $15 million. Like, I bought a house. I bought artwork. I started investing in all these like crappy companies that I did not know the first thing about, you know, proper angel investing. And I would invest way too much of my money and without contracts and without any understanding of, you know, how angel investing works. And I'd start new companies that were horrible, and I just blew it all. I just pissed it all away. Everything. I ended up with zero.
What was the worst investment you made? And it doesn't even need to have been in a company.
Well, the worst investment wasn't a company. I invested in this company that made like wireless devices for deaf people so they could text each other, i.e. what's now called a smartphone. But, you know, they went public, and I had $2 million in them, and I wrote it all the way down to zero. And so that was just one of many bad investments I made.
Oh man. So after you lost essentially everything, what did you do next? I know you had kind of a dark period. Do you want to talk about that maybe?
Well, it's all connected. I mean, nobody like says, oh, I lost all my money. I worked really, really hard for not 2 years, for 4 years. Plus I worked another 10 years before that, building up the skill set that allowed me to build my company. So I worked really, really hard for 14 years, sold a company, made a lot of money, and now I'm down to zero, and nobody values my skill set anymore, and no one values what I did, and I'm at zero. I'm starting from scratch. And so no one says, oh, this is pretty cool. Now I get to start from scratch again. I was miserable. I was depressed. I was suicidal. I was really scared. I was scared more than anything else. Like people, maybe suicidal is the same as way as saying I was really scared. Like I was so scared I didn't know what I would do at all. I also started getting interested in investing, which is kind of contradictory because you would think, oh, you just lost all your money investing. Why would you be interested in that? It's because I lost all my money while investing. I realized, oh my gosh, I am not the smartest guy in the world at everything I do. I was only smart at this one little thing that I succeeded at. And then when I tried to succeed at these other things, I failed miserably. And you know, the key thing is like my wife at the time, she wanted me to sue not only my stockbroker, but all the people who got me into all these investments. And it kind of reminds me of in stand-up comedy, if you bomb, you know, if you fail, like nobody laughs at your jokes. It's really easy to sort of blame the audience, like, oh my gosh, the entire audience was from Norway and they didn't even speak English. And but more importantly, it's much harder to blame yourself and to take responsibility for your own actions. Like even if nobody speaks English, there's ways that you can handle it better on a variety of levels, like on at least a dozen different levels. And I've always been the type of person to take responsibility for my own failures. And that's a really important skill. And I think now that's a really important skill looking back on it. I didn't really think it then. I was just more miserable and suicidal all the time. And so it was really important for me to take responsibility for my failures, to learn from them. And so here I was doing all this investing. And I said, okay, I need to learn about investing a bit more. And when I say a bit more, I went into my typical obsessive mode. So wait, I need to write notes down on this because I'm learning about myself while I talk to you here. So obsessive, blame myself. Doesn't sound like good qualities to have, but I like this idea. Let's work this out. So all the bad things that are important skills. Mm-hmm. So being obsessive, blaming myself, which is the same as taking responsibility. Being aware that you're stupid is really important.
So when you're in like a deep valley or, you know, depression, you've just had a big failure, something like that, do you feel like it's important to focus on what your next win could be to pull you out? Or is there another way that you typically use to dig out of that?
I think, yes, it is important to focus on what your next win could be, but you might not have any idea what that next win is. I certainly didn't know. You know, to some extent too, like I got obsessive about investing. So I read probably more than 200 books on investing. I started spending time with hedge fund managers, and that was a whole story how I managed to do that. I started day trading and losing money again. Day trading, because you can't do anything the first time and be good at it. It's just not gonna work. But everybody wants to day trade and be successful. But in order to get good, you still have to do that. You still have to be bad the first time you do something. You have to be willing to be bad. So and not only be willing, you have to try to be. You have to on purpose be bad. Not try to be bad, but on purpose be bad. Like I'm not going to. Let's say I love golf, all right? Like golf's a sport I certainly can play. Like basketball, I can't play. I'm too old and not tall enough and so on. But golf, I could certainly pick up and try to get better at. But in order to do it, I've got to be bad the first time. And I've got to be willing to be bad the first time, or else I'm just going to quit. And if you're not willing to be bad the first time, you're never going to get better. And not only the first time, maybe for the first 15 years that you do it. So how do you get better if you're going to be bad for the first 15 years? Well, you have to sort of decide, well, what are small successes I can achieve along the way? Like maybe with golf, I want to go from, and I'm not even joking, I might want to go from a 60 handicap, which is probably my current handicap, to a 50 handicap. and then I'm gonna celebrate with all my golf friends.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe another small win is I want to get lessons from the best golf player I can get lessons from. And that'll be a small successful thing. Because you gotta learn from the best. You gotta model yourself after the best.
Right, but I think that's something so many people are allergic to. Even me sometimes, being bad at anything for a period of time. So how do you get the courage to push that first domino over and accept, all right, you know, I'm gonna suck at this for a while, but I'm going to commit to keep doing it?
I don't know. It's really hard. Like a lot of it depends on kind of, you know, Carol Dweck has a book called Mindset. It's the, I forget the two mindsets, the growth mindset and the other mindset. I forget what she calls it. But some people are willing to just kind of celebrate growth. Other people are like, they have the mindset, well, I'm talented. I should be good at this already. And they have a hard, those types of people have a hard time with growth. Now, you're not fixed as to one or the other, but you kind of start off as one or the other. And I probably started off as the bad one, and I had to learn the hard way, the good one. But Ira Glass refers to this also. He calls it the skill gap. Let's say you love painting. Okay, you love it. I'll just use my own experiences. So for the past 5 months, two or three times a week, I've been doing stand-up comedy at professional clubs, like not open mics, but like with a real, like I'm going on tonight. Everybody else going on has like their hour long Netflix special. And then there's me. So I have loved comedy for, you know, 30 years or more. And when I was at HBO, I would cover a lot of comedy stuff for them. Like I would go to the Aspen Comedy Festival every year. I would interview all sorts of comedians like Rodney Dangerfield, George Carlin, you know, David Cross, Bob Odenkirk. I would go every night out to comedy clubs and run into all my friends at HBO. But then there would be people just starting out, like Amy Poehler, Marc Maron, like all these guys, Janine Garofalo, all these people just starting out and doing their thing at the back of some seedy bar in the Lower East Side. And so I loved it. And for 30 years, I've been paying attention to it and really appreciating the subtleties of what makes somebody good versus what makes somebody not so good versus what makes somebody bad. Like there's thousands and thousands of subtleties. So when I started doing it two or three times a week, I was like, oh, I don't have any of these skills at all. Like despite the fact that I've been watching this and doing this for 30 years, being involved in this industry for 30 years, I have zero of these skills. Maybe a few from public speaking, because I do have 20 years experience public speaking, but I don't have any of these other skills at all, other than having like a natural sense of humor, which by the way is not a huge part of stand-up comedy. And so this that's called the skill gap, where you're smart enough and you love something enough to recognize the subtleties of the greats, but then also realize that when you start, you have none of them. And that's the gap. And that gap is a 20-year gap to fill. Now, it doesn't mean 20 years until you're successful. It means you have to figure out lots of ways to judge success along the way. And it also means you might want to do what I call the umbrella effect, which is not just do stand-up, because you might not want to wait 20 years or in Louis C.K.'s case, 28 years before you're filling up Madison Square Garden as a stand-up comedian. You might want to submit jokes to late night shows. You might write a script. You might write a novel. You might use humor in sales or in public speaking or in motivational speaking. there's lots of ways. There's what I call the umbrella theory, which is get good at many of the things that are involved in a career with the heading you want. So investing has many different ways to get successful. You could be a successful day trader. You could be a successful hedge fund manager. You could be a successful mutual fund manager. By the way, those three things are different skills. You could be a successful stockbroker, also a different skill. You could be a successful writer about investments. You could be a successful book author. You could be a successful angel investor or advise companies on raising money from investors. So there are many different sub-skills and categories with any broader umbrella category. So that's what I call the umbrella theory of achieving success, something I do plan to write about, but I haven't yet written about.
All right, James, now I've got a few of my frequently asked questions that I want to run by you, and they're designed to be intentionally short on my end. Your answers do not need to be equally so. What's your number one piece of advice to someone who wants to start working on validating their business idea today?
See if there's a customer. So I'll give you an example. A friend of mine gets involved in lots of businesses, like not just one business. He's a professional business starter, and he doesn't have the skills himself to build a business or invent a new product, but he'll say, okay, I've got this guy, this guy, this guy. I've got this professional quarterback who's famous, who will be a spokesperson. I've got these potential customers. I've got this inventor. He'll bring them all together in a room. And if magic happens, then he's got a business. And so recently for him, after many tries, some magic happened. And he found a product with a good spokesperson. And a major nationally known police force, you know, major cities police force likes his product. And he's got an inventor who invented a new product that every police force in the country needs. So now he's got a business. So he validated it without making a single sale and without putting down a single dime of money. So the key is there's lots of ways to validate an idea. He's been doing it for a long time, so he's able to bring everybody into the same room. But you can also say, is this novel idea good? Let's put an ad up on Facebook with a cover. Hedge fund thriller. Guy makes millions, but then finds out that all his millions is dirty cryptocurrency money, you know, and then you have an ad and you see if people click on it. If nobody clicks on it, your book idea is probably no good. You know, I just made that up on the fly. That's like, you know, one way to validate an idea.
So you, more than many people, have experienced and written about the highs and lows of being an entrepreneur. What advice do you have to our listeners who might be struggling with the anxiety or maybe even depression around the state of their business or life?
Well, you mentioned the anxiety. The anxiety never goes away. So just accept it and go, you know, do whatever you can personally, whether it's talk therapy or meditation or medication or yoga, whatever it is you do, do it to fight anxiety. Because the anxiety of running a business is enormous. There's a reason why an employee of a company makes 1/100th of what an entrepreneur makes. It's because the boss, the boss's boss, the boss's boss's boss, and so on, they handle some of the anxiety for you. But that's why they take most of the money of every dollar of value you create. So if you're going to start your own business, it's going to be – you're going to make more money because you're going to get all of that value yourself, but you're also going to have more anxiety. The other thing is blame yourself. Take responsibility. Take ownership of your own problems and faults. There's nobody else to blame. If you waste time blaming anyone else, you're not moving forward. That's just – a fact. The other thing is you got to love what you're doing. If you don't love what you're doing, and by the way, there's not just one love or one passion that you have, but we're talking about whatever it is you're doing. If you don't love it, you're going to lose to the person who does love what they're doing. And love might not be the same. Maybe I mean something different. Maybe I mean have a vision, have a really strong vision for what you're doing. If you don't have a strong vision that you can persuade people is different and unique from everyone else's vision, and you feel passionate about it and you can passionately express it, you're going to lose to your competitors who do have that vision. So I guess those are the most important things.
So what kinds of sacrifices would you say you've made over the years in order to put enough time? What's that?
I just want to add, be obsessive. Sorry, go ahead.
Be obsessive. All right. So what kinds of sacrifices would you say you've made over the years in order to put enough time and effort into the businesses that you feel have paid off?
Well, you don't know. When you look back at the past, you don't know what would have paid off differently than other things. And I regret having so much focus on money because I never really loved doing something just for money. And I only really made the most money anyway when I did other things that I loved. So I don't know. When your focus is on money, you're not going to be happy. You're going to be even more stressed than you should be. You're not going to be the best at what you do. And I kind of regret that. I regret it's an, because you're going to have to work harder because you're not going to be as obsessed. You're going to miss out on doing things you enjoy. And you know, you only live life once. So if you waste like 10, 15 years pursuing something just for the money, you've really like just shot your life to hell. Not that you can't recover, because look, I've been through that and I'm recovering, but I'm a recovering money-holic. But, you know, I would say that's a big regret of mine.
What advice would you give to our listeners today who want to start a blog, and particularly around how to get their first, call it 100 or 1,000 readers?
You do want to think of who your readership is, but the most important thing is you want to get good at writing. So read a lot. The only way to get writing, there's two things. Read a lot every day. Read. And don't just read BS blogs out there. Read the best books in history to learn how to be a good writer. Just read quality all the time, every day. And then write. And make sure you're writing something that even just a little bit is different from something anybody else has ever written, or you say something written in a different way. So I'll give you an example. I love Seth Godin's blogs. I highly recommend people check them out. But he seldom tells personal stories. That's just his way. He doesn't like to tell personal stories. So sometimes I notice some of my ideas might intersect with some of his ideas, but I tell personal stories all the time. And as long as I have my own unique way of writing, which you could only develop if you write every single day. And again, it's going to take you years and years and years. So you have to learn how to celebrate small successes along the way. I'm going to write that down, small successes along the way. You got to just read and write and write. And then you got to publish every day. And then after you've written like maybe 30 or 40 blogs for like a year or so, then start thinking, yeah, you do have to think about an audience all the time, because you're not just writing for yourself. That's very sort of self, who cares what you think if you don't think about the audience. But, it takes time to build up an audience. Like, don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. Don't think you're going to write one post and suddenly have 20,000 shares on it. Like, it takes a long time.
Mm-hmm. So, James, this is my last question for you. What's been the best investment you've ever made in the context of growing a business? And that can be in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, or otherwise.
The best investment I've ever made is an investment in my own ability to write and communicate. Is that a cop-out answer? But I'm serious. I've made more money from my own ability to communicate, which took years and years and years to develop, than anything else. So, I've spawned off so many different types of businesses. It's introduced me to so many different opportunities that I've been able to invest in that have themselves grown. I've had business successes before then, which worked out really well, like, you know, selling my website design business, but, you know, or selling other businesses. But my own ability to write and communicate in my own unique style has been a better investment for me than anything else by far.
I love that.
Because that's something that never goes away either. Like, I have mm-hmm. that skill now.
Yeah, so, and arguably it grows with time.
Yeah.
All right, awesome. Well, James, thank you for joining us again. Can you tell our listeners here today where they can find you online and check out everything you're up to?
You can find me everywhere online. That's the other thing I do really well. I syndicate everywhere. If you'd like to go on LinkedIn, I'm there. If you'd like to go on Facebook, I'm there. Twitter, I'm there. If you want to go to my podcast, go to iTunes or Stitcher. If you want to go to my website, jamesaltucher.com. If you want to go Instagram, I even write articles on Instagram. I'm the only one I know who's probably written entire articles on Instagram.
Awesome. All right. Well, James, thank you for being here.
Okay. Thanks so much for asking me, Ryan. I really appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. And one more thing before you go. I want to give a special thanks again to FreshBooks, our sponsor for this episode of the Side Hustle Project, for making this possible. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial of their cloud accounting and invoicing software to listeners of the Side Hustle Project. To claim your free trial, just go to freshbooks.com/Ryan and enter the Side Hustle Project in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Thanks for tuning in.